From the Sky News Centre at 5, the wife of a church organist beaten to death in Sheffield on Christmas Eve hasn't read a letter from the man who admitted his murder. 22-year-old Jonathan Bowling will spend at least 25 years in prison. Ashley Foster, who's also 22, has been jailed for 9 years for the manslaughter of Alan Greaves. Bowling wrote to his victim's widow Maureen, but she's asked a police officer to keep it.
I've decided not to read the letter. I've given it to Mr. Fenwick to hold on my behalf, just in case the day comes when I do want to read it, to put it into my hands on the day that he was going to get sentenced. I didn't think it was appropriate.
Police in the West Midlands say they have no information to suggest those who visit mosques in the area are at risk from a bombing campaign. Within the last month, 3 separate devices have been detonated near mosques. Last night, police in Wolverhampton found debris from a blast they think happened 3 weeks ago. The Chancellor's giving tax breaks to companies involved in fracking, the controversial method of extracting gas from deep below the ground. But environmental groups are worried the technique could contaminate water supplies. A £150,000 donation made to a children's hospice after a woman died trying to swim the English Channel for charity is thought to have been a hoax. Susan Taylor got into difficulty close to the French coast on Sunday. That's the latest. I'm Chloe Culpin.
Tune in each and every Sunday between the hours of 10 and 12. In the meantime...
It's Friday, 5 o'clock. BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. And helping us review this week's news is Deputy Leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, Councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, it's tax-free mansions for the super rich. But if you don't have a job, tough. You have a choice, either go to the food bank or if you have one, get evicted from your home. There are still between 15 and 19,000 officially homeless in Bristol. A failure of central government or the local councils to build social housing. One Bristolian, Tony Crofts, is determined to change all that and provide a safe investment for Bristolians to boot. Also, investing the money in converting offices to social housing, doing the council's job for them. And as the man himself seems to be recovering well in hospital, Bristol celebrates Nelson Mandela's birthday tomorrow. Phil McCowan is one of the organisers. The birthday isn't tomorrow, the celebration is. Phil's here to explain why this former terrorist is worth celebrating and what kind of party is being planned. Plus Martin Summers on a tour of the world's hot spots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Lows of 16 Celsius tonight and dry. This weekend, highs of 27, sunny with some light cloud. Next week, highs again around 30 degrees Celsius, sunnier and hotter at the beginning of the week, but colder with heavy showers and thunderous conditions towards the end of the week. Next weekend, that's 27th and 28th of July, highs of 20 Celsius, fairly sunny. So time to head for Portishead Open Air Swimming Pool, or down to street to that open air swimming pool. And also maybe time for Bristol City Council to think about building an open air swimming pool or reopening one here somewhere for some of us 350,000 people. That was Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. And helping us review this week's news is Deputy Leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, Councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. Ron, let's start on that specific point about open air swimming pools. Why do we have to go down to street or over to Portishead if we want to go in an open air pool?
Well, there were originally a number of open air facilities. One was in Clifton and the other one was Henley's Lake that people swam in. Over the years, of course, the problem has been finding the cash and the ability to be able to run them and to be able to run them 52 weeks a year.
Okay, hang on a minute, hold it right there, because down in Portishead what's happened, the local people have just clubbed together, they're running it now and they're making money.
Well, I know that, but as you know, we lost Speedwell Pool in East Bristol wrongly, and we've been fighting to try and restore that ever since.
Well, when you say that, how did Bristol, how can Bristol just go lose a pool?
Well, it's because the 1950s pools were all up for modernisation, and there was a replacement programme planned, which the Liberal Democrat administration tore up and decided to save certain pools in their areas, but to sacrifice those in areas that didn't vote for them. And Freight Speedwell came out second best.
Henley's leisure centres were fairly new. I mean, a lot of the new ones are, they're privatised, aren't they? They're private, yes, run by private operators, and I imagine PFIs.
A lot of them were originally PFIs. I think you'll find Henbury was, in relation to the development as well at Henbury School. That was a PFI, certainly. But we've got some capital money for it, but thanks to the, again, Liberal Democrat administration, it didn't put any revenue costs in the budget. We haven't got the facility to be able to run and pay the staff, so we would have to find a partner to actually run any pool we build from now on.
Martin, I mean, I know you've got a little detailed knowledge of swimming pools. I don't know how often you go swimming in Bristol, but what was the economics of this and the politics of it? Why is it that the pools in the city are being slowly sold off? The thing is, down in Portishead, people have made a success of that open-air pool. Everyone in North Somerset was being told, and by Portishead Town Council, this pool is never going to work. I'm afraid it's just not value for money, and then it was closed. But the local people have shown that to be a lie.
Yeah, but you've got to recognise that there's such a thing as cultural capital, and people in Portishead have got more cultural capital than people in East Bristol. They are likely to have resources, time, you know, to do something like that. And that's not to say that people in East Bristol are passive. It's just that the, you know, people, if you're relying upon private social initiative, you're going to find a very mixed bag. We had a system when I worked for the council. We had the council social economy section, as it were, or the sort of social section of Kobe City Council, come to visit Bristol.
Well, where's that?
That's in Japan. It's the Kobe is actually the birthplace of the Yamaguchi Gumi, the Yakuza. But of course, they also had the...
What, is that some sort of mafia? Or
yes, the mafia. But they also had the earthquake there. But these people, they were all employed by the council, so they'd leave university or school and they'd go to work for the council. And working for the council is like a hugely prestigious job. It's a job for life. And they run all of the kind of things like swimming pools, social stuff, you know, community centres, all run by these people. And they came to look at Bristol, because Bristol's got a reputation all over the world for having this kind of social economy, where we've got all these kind of, you know, community centres run by locals and so on. But they made some very good pertinent criticisms of the way we run things. They said, well, if you've got a situation like that, doesn't it end up with a situation where those who've got the loudest voices end up getting what they want, and less privileged areas don't get anything? Mm. And that, they were right onto that straight away. They immediately picked it up. And they said, the other thing that's really problematic about the way you work, we've got jobs for life, and we've paid for this trip out of our own money because we're really dedicated people. You people are looking over your shoulder all the time and looking where your next paycheck's coming from and where your next job's coming from. Think of all, I mean, I've worked in the social sector all my life, and most of the people spend half their time, if you've got three years funding, the second half of your 3 years you're spending looking for another job or looking for more funding. That doesn't happen in Japan. They just get on with it. We are Kobe people from Kobe. We are going to fix Kobe, and this, it wouldn't work for us.
So what you're saying,
but I'm just saying, that's the problem with all of this kind of social initiative,
because
stuff.
we're talking about this in after 6 o'clock with Tony Crofts, talking about you know, citizens in Bristol taking over empty office buildings, developing them and then running them as an investment. What I suppose you're saying is that in large parts of Bristol, in large parts of the city, people don't have money to put in as an investment.
Or even time. Yeah, do you see what I mean? People have got time to do things. And also, that, you know, if somebody's got to do the accounts, if we've got anybody who's an accountant, all these things like that matter. I'm not saying that I'm against social activism, of course I'm not, but people shouldn't see it as a kind of silver bullet for things. What you also need is a properly funded, properly organised setup that makes sure that everybody gets a bite of the cherry. And that is the way they run it in Japan. And they looked at the way we do it, where we contract everything out to the third sector, and they said, well, we'd rather just keep it in-house because we know what we're doing. And they were very, very... they were very impressed with some of the stuff they saw in Bristol, but they were very critical.
There is a Lido in Clifton, isn't there? But it's quite expensive to get in there. The only other place I can think of which is a sensible price to go to is Cirencester. I mean, it's not on, is it? In weather like this, we want an open-air pool, Ron.
Well, I understand that, and you can join the queue, but coming back to what we were saying about, if you like, the abilities and the money levels, I've said it before on this programme, my ward is 12 foot 6, the wrong side of a line for 28 years. And that is meant to say government grant for so any projects like this, social projects if you like, betterment of the local area, community centres, swimming pools or whatever, has gone to other areas in the city, but it's not come to Bristol East, and we are a deprived area, and we struggle with the current criteria to be able to qualify for crumbs, let alone, you know, a loaf of bread.
Is it fair to say, Ron, that that there is actually a some kind of community bonus that comes out of that, because areas that are deprived, often people are more interreliant?
Well, they are interreliant, but again, the point's been made in basically being able to get a reasonable standard of living with both child support, the need for two people to work, etc., etc. They haven't got the spare capacity to be able to take on community projects full time. And that's the main issue.
It's time, isn't it?
Yes.
Ron, we've got a bit of a situation now with central government where a lot of people are saying, well, the Labour Party is actually drifting towards the coalition policies, particularly on things like social security, where they're saying, oh, we've got to cap these benefits now. Of course, that means if there's any kind of runaway inflation, very, very quickly, people are going to be starving. They're just simply not going to have anywhere near enough money to get them up to the very basic levels of thresholds of poverty. What's going on in the Labour Party? Why is it drifting towards the Cameron point of view? In fact, some people are even saying, in some of the commentators in the national press, even saying that Labour is doing the Conservatives' job for them, actually almost endorsing what they're doing.
Well, to be honest, the 50-year membership of the Labour Party, I wouldn't disagree with that statement. Things that are going on nationally at the minute with what is on the social agenda from our political opponents, I'm horrified that we're not openly opposing all the cuts in relation to social welfare. I think it is totally unfair, but what I have tried to do locally in the last month was to recognise the impact of the bedroom tax and to put a motion to the City Council about non-evictions and reclassification. And to my surprise, even the Tories voted for that.
Incredible. So, I mean, one of the things we've been talking about was saying, as a really drastic measure, people can get breeze blocks and cement and actually brick up a bedroom, and then they would be able to stay in their homes. I mean,
well, I know it. That's crazy, but I mean, we've got the power as a council to be able to do something about it, and I honestly didn't expect a total cross-party unanimous vote, and that's taken a number of places.
You're thinking of starting a coalition with the Conservatives now?
No.
Well, we're in one, Ron, aren't we? Are we not at the moment, effectively?
I'm not.
Certainly that's the case in Greece, isn't it? I mean, maybe extrapolating a bit much there, but this is one of the things that's happening in Greece is that the conservative, traditional conservative type party in Greece is now in coalition with the Labour Party. Can you see that happening here in Britain, Ron, at national level?
No.
Easy answer.
No. And if it did, I'll tell you this, I would resign for the Labour Party that day it happened.
Well, some people will be trying to make that happen now you've said that, Ron.
Well, that's true.
Anyway,
28 years they've failed so far.
We're quite lucky in Bristol in having our little version of Private Eye. Not all the stories are accurate. I don't think you could say that for the mainstream press either. But the Bristolian has been talking about senior figures at the ailing waste management company May Gurney, and the city signed a contract with them to sort out all our waste, might not have time to enjoy any windfall payments from the merger with Kia. The company's so in debt, May Gurney, that they've been now taken over by another company called Kia. Can you tell us a bit about that company? I mean, this is a private company that runs all our waste services, about to fall to pieces, and these people, Kia, have stepped in to save them. I mean, the first question, I suppose, is what would have happened if they'd just gone bust? Would we just be looking at no rubbish collections and the council being stitched up on the contract?
Well, the council has been stitched up on the contract right from the beginning, because right at the start of this, I actually went to Cabinet and Council and told them not to take on May Gurney because of their past history in other parts of the country with failures, etc. For 2 years I've kept a log of failures in Bristol East in relation to all types of street collection and waste. And indeed, the contract, when Gary Hopkins worked it out with his calculator, he needed a new set of batteries because it turned out to be much more expensive than we thought. And indeed, the service that May Gurney's given in Bristol East has been atrocious. In other parts of the city, it seems to be moderately acceptable to most people. But in Bristol East, the continual complaints that come out in relation to things like assisted collections, for example, that you may have one failure but should be relatively easy to reconnect, keep failing.
What do you mean by an assisted collection?
This is disabled people that cannot manage to manipulate a large bin full of rubbish for themselves. And what happens is the crew actually goes to the bin and replaces it in the back garden. And so we had disabled people with piles of rubbish in their hallways over Christmas. And I mean, it was ridiculous. And what we've now got with this new company, Care, is a company that's got a very bad reputation for picking on particularly trade union activists within any company or waste collection service. And if they raise health and safety issues, they are either sacked, and if they are sacked, they're blacklisted, and you end up not being able to get another job in somebody that you know. And I think that's absolutely atrocious.
That's the same sort of thing that was going on in the building industry too, isn't it? And other industries, probably still, we've still to find out. But I mean, ultimately, surely that's up to the Care Group, if they want to do that, if they want to actually give the names of people who've been causing trouble in the organisation to another organisation to share with other big industrial concerns. That's up to them. There's no law against it, Ron, is there?
There's no law against it, but I do object when people are taking proper, if you like, question out or indeed action for the safety of workers or indeed residents that and the way in which they operate. And I cannot see that that is legal or indeed people would support it.
But Martin, blacklisting is actually not, as far as we know, illegal, is it?
No, but the point is, if you're going to get a contract from the public, from the city council, you are best practice or you're not on that contract. And best practice involves no blacklisting. So any company that's been involved in any kind of blacklisting, we should just turn around to them and say, no government contracts for you at local or national level. If we are the Labour Party and we are in power, that is the reality. Oh, and you might as well close that company down now, because once we get to power, you will never work for us again. And in actual fact, you're totally dependent on the public purse. So it's about time you got into line or get out.
Ron, tell us some more about what you found out about May Gurney during their contract. Now they're being taken over by Keir. It's quite interesting to give it a bit of a review. And maybe you can tell us, is it mostly your constituents who live up in St George West that have been coming to you and telling you this and that? Yeah.
Yeah. I've got a file that's about an inch thick now. And what it relates to is just about every part of the contract you can believe. From a simple thing like the new bins and bin deliveries and the changeover, the way in which they leave the bins after they've, collected rubbish. You've got to go down halfway down the street to find your own. How they manage to do that, I'm not quite sure. Weed control, weed spraying, fly tipping, the local bins on corners that don't get collected, and so they end up with piles of rubbish on street corners, etc. The litter they leave behind them, you know, it's endless.
I've seen this in some of the parks actually over the last couple of weeks, particularly when a lot of people have been out and about, is the bins are just absolutely crammed full of ice cream wrappers and goodness knows what, and the rubbish is then blowing around, you
exactly.
know, because it's not been emptied.
Can I just say, the people from Kobe would just roll their eyes at all of this. I'm quite sure that they collect their rubbish in-house in Kobe, as they've always done. And they've got a system in place which has not changed in a generation. And they don't even argue about it. It's just done.
Yeah. But again, what we've come down to is that we've asked May Gurney to come to neighbourhood partnership meetings twice to meet disgruntled tenants and residents. And they haven't turned up. And I challenged the actual manager of Bristol East for May Gurney at a different meeting, which he did turn up at. Now, funnily enough, it was Bristol in Bloom to go and talk to the good ladies of Clifton, but not Bristol East. and he told me that the company had instructed him not to, or their workers not to turn up at neighbouring partnerships.
But isn't this symptomatic of the whole business of privatising services like this, where, you know, in the old days, if it was a council employee, they would simply be told by the director of their service, you will go along to this meeting. In fact, by councillors in the area, they could tell them to do it. Nowadays, when things are privatised, and this works on a national level too, it's one step removed, isn't it? Actually, the management is not by the council anymore. So every time something is privatised, we heard about last week about Royal Mail being privatised, it actually means your vote means less.
I know, and that's a very sad issue, but we're still struggling with this, and we're going to get to the bottom of it, because I've put these questions to Cabinet, 15 questions that I've been trying to get an answer from last October, and it's been deliberately ducked by the City Council, and so I put it on the next Cabinet meeting. And if I don't get an answer, I'm going for a Freedom of Information request to get it, because I think it's in the public interest to know what is the exact
state. Well, I would go for your Freedom of Information request now, Ron, don't wait. Anyway, another thing in this fascinating little article in the June edition of the Bristolian, and you can pick it up from places like Radical Bookshops, pubs like the Plough in Easton, for example, it is about Jack Lopresti. This is the Freemason Conservative MP for Filton and Bradley Stoke. At least one person in Bristol is pleased with how the City Council's waste contract with serial blunderers, they say here, May Gurney, has turned out. While household recycling might go uncollected, streets remain uncleaned and fly tipping is overlooked. In City Hall's former waste services contracts manager is one Giovanni Lopresti, who personally negotiated, apparently, this is according to the Bristolian, and oversaw the flawed and expensive contract with the rubbish waste collectors. But they are unlikely to care. The Giovanni, younger brother of Filton's low-profile Tory MP, except in Saudi Arabia when he's doing arms deals for BAE Systems over there, Giacomo Jack Lopresti. He was made an offer he couldn't refuse and now has a well-paid job as contract manager with May Gurney. So this is, admittedly, this is just according to this report in the Bristolian, but it's his brother that was actually negotiated this contract, and now he's got landed himself a job with May Gurney, apparently will be picked up, and now he'll be being paid by Keir as well. This is a revolving door syndrome, it seems, going on, Ron, here. Right in the middle of this contract.
Right in the middle, and right as you say, and it really does lay the lie of we're all in it together, unless you're going from Eton Harrow or in the correct family links. Clearly there are the abilities to manipulate contracts and be able to have a fairly hefty lifestyle, I would have thought.
Martin, it looks like people like Giovanni Lopresti, whilst working for the City Council on rather a nice salary, very good terms and conditions, have been approached by Keir, or in fact in this case May Gurney, and said, well, if you can get this contract for us, we're going to a nice job for you.
Yeah, I don't suppose there's any overt fraud here. We're not saying that. It's just interesting, isn't it, that an MP's brother ends up being running May Gurney, which we've got all these problems with.
But the point I'm making is that he's organising this contract on behalf of the taxpayer with May Gurney, but then he suddenly finds himself with a job for May Gurney.
Oh yes. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, is this commonplace, you think?
Well, it is, and I think the problem, you see, people, we should never have contracted these services out. I mean, I know it sounds like I'm a dinosaur
The thing is, you can't rewrite history.
Well, no, you can't, but in actual fact, in Japan, they never even bothered to go down this road. They just thought this is stupid and didn't do it. And the problem is that the problem with modern conservatives in this country is they ain't conservative. They've always got a new harebrained scheme to push. They've always got a new get rich quick project, you know. And in actual fact, what we need to do is just learn how we used to do it and do it like we used to do it and do it properly.
Ron?
I wouldn't disagree with any of that. Like I said, I didn't want these people in the first place. I didn't want the contract to go out house. I fought when I was an Avon councillor to keep all contracts in, because I was in charge of contracts at that point. And I'm afraid it's a heart back to Thatcherism, because she started it.
That's right, and the damage is cumulative. and we get used to it as well. So we get used to the fact that the railways can't be run on time and it's a hopeless shambles. And other countries look at us, like Finland or whatever, they look at us, what is the matter with you people? Can't you see that none of this is going to work? But we get so used to it, because it happens all the time, that we end up arguing about which company we should allow to rip us off, rather than why is any company ripping us off?
Well, one good piece of news, of course, at the moment is the possibility of this royal baby that's just about to arrive. So rather than sort of wax lyrical about that, I thought what we'd do this week is have a look at some of the downside of the royal family, whilst the whole of the rest of the country looks at how wonderful they are. But the place to start with something like this is to talk to you. Marina Morris has been out on the streets of Bristol to ask you what you make of the modern royal family.
Is the royal family value for money?
Yes, they are. I think they fly the flag for the UK and they represent us very well abroad.
Well, I just don't think that there's ever been a kind of cost appraisal really with the royal family, that because we never take into account the costs of their kind of security costs, how much we lose because of the Duchy of Cornwall and the Duchy of Lancaster. So they're both, you know, lost incomes for the country. The same people say they bring in tourists, but we could open up, you know, Buckingham Palace, then let people go in there, and that would get a lot more money doing it that way.
I've actually been in London this week, and you see how crazy people go around the sort of royal, you know, Buckingham Palace and that. So I do think it's great for tourism, and if we didn't have the monarchy, then I don't think we'd attract people in the same numbers.
They raise awareness for charities. They're funny, especially Prince Harry.
The UK is a better place with a royal family rather than without one.
I'm Irish, so no.
Yes, I think they promote a lot of community value, I suppose, and family value within Great Britain. I think it's quite nice for everybody to come together.
They make a lot of money, don't they, from tourists? So we do actually bring a lot of money in from them, but I don't think they're really necessary.
No, I don't think so either. And when you put it in comparison to something like that, it's a waste of money when it could be money well spent somewhere else.
Brilliant. I do love them.
That's what I said. That's a lot of money.
That is a lot of money, but I do love
them.
Do you love Kate Middleton?
Yeah.
And Prince William. We love them a lot.
Should Prince Charles get tax breaks?
No, Prince Charles should pay the same tax as everyone else. I think that's the only fair. That's fair.
No, it's not about why not. It's about why should he? So, you know, we all earn income. We all pay tax.
Completely agree. I don't think we should all be subject to. I don't think there should be any differentiation. We should all be subject to the same.
I think it's things like that, which is why people dislike the royal family.
Something like the Prince's Trust, if they're doing really good work and helping young people and spurring future entrepreneurs on to X million pounds for the country in the future, then that's fair enough. But any other sort of industry that he's involved in should pay their way.
Yeah, it depends. I don't know what he does. If he gets tax breaks just for being a royal, kind of fine. He's a royal. It's not that much money if it's spread out over all the country.
No, I don't think he should be the same as everybody else, really.
He should most definitely pay tax.
Yeah, definitely. It's the same. Why is he any different to anybody else? He should
probably pay tax.
Yeah.
Anyone that's over the boundaries should,
like everyone
regardless,
else in Britain. Yeah, definitely. Yep.
Should Prince Charles be exempt from the Freedom of Information Act?
No, he should have to abide by the same rules as everyone else. So if that includes the Freedom of Information Act, it should include it.
No, it's a law. He should abide by it.
No, exactly. Yeah, completely agree. Same as the last question. We should all be treated in exactly the same way.
By having kind of exemptions from the Freedom of Information Act, it just kind of causes people to distrust them a little bit more. So it's probably in his interest to not be exempt from it.
If it's work in the public eye, then he should be subject to the Freedom of Information Act. There's kind of a duty to be transparent like that, I guess. Under certain circumstances, if a situation's elaborate or needs to be worked out, then maybe the actual freeing up of the information might be delayed.
As in the public can't find things out about him? Yeah, I'd say so. Unless it's in the public interest to know those things, then yeah, I'd say so. Yeah, he should be, definitely.
I think personal matters, yes, but if it's to do with MPs and stuff, then no.
If it's to do with something that's going to affecting everyone.
The public or society, then definitely. We should all be able to know.
No.
No, again, no.
In some, maybe that, no, but in some ways, yes.
Okay, there's someone at the end there that couldn't quite make themselves clear anyway. Ron, I suppose ultimately here what we're dealing with is separating the idea of Prince Charles, particularly as an individual, and his role as in government, because the reason I asked that last question, it's actually quite nice to hear there's lots of goodwill out there for the royal family. They want them to be great, but they're actually, I mean, most people seem to be a bit annoyed about these tax exemptions, and also particularly exemption from Freedom of Information Act, because this is nothing to do with Charles's personal life. This is to do with these so-called black spider letters that the Guardian has been tracking for years, where he's writing letters to ministers, asking them questions, asking them to do things. There's also the fact that he vetoes laws, I mean, laws that have been passed by both the House of Commons and the House of Lords. If they affect Charles's estates, he vetoes them. He basically just scratches out the law, which doesn't sound very democratic to me. What do you think of this balance between Charles as a private person, Charles as a government representative, and Charles as a corporation? Because he's a big corporation, the Duchy of Cornwall.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've got the Duchy of Cornwall estate out in Newton St Low, haven't we? And quite a lot of the land between Newton St Low and Marksbury are all part of the Duchy of Cornwall estate. It's a bit sad that some of that is still, if you like, in the domain of the Duchy of Cornwall, which probably started with the Peasants' Revolt of about 1350, and, you know, Enclosure Acts and one thing and another. But to be honest, I mean, Charles has obviously got a number of roles to play. In one way, I feel sorry for him, because I think his, if you like, constitutional role that he was forced to have to accept from a very young age, just being the potential next king, and how that affected his childhood and his relationship with families and being sent off, you know, to Scotland, you know, and away from the family, etc. I think that's had an effect on him. I think there are elements that he tries to do which are quite interesting and green, and, you know, good luck to him for that. But let's face it, the whole of the royal family do exist on public money and public taxes. It's only recently they've started to pay some of the real tax levels, and if you look at some of the travel costs in relation to what the benefits were and why they went there, it's really, if you like, clutching at straws of history in relation to what the British Empire used to be like, or the British Commonwealth.
But I'm pinning it down to this recent news story about the black spider letters.
Yeah.
Dominic Grieve argued that the disclosure of the 27 particularly frank letters between Prince Charles and the ministers over a seven-month period would have seriously damaged his future role of king, which does make you wonder, what is in those letters that people might not actually see in those letters the Prince Charles that we see on TV, this nice, squeaky clean ear? Image.
Yeah, I know. Well, we don't know, do we? But if he is actually, you know, riding roughshod over the law, and how that affects his estate and his ability to function as he sees it, he's in a very privileged position to be able to do that. And it seems to me that somewhere out in the West Country, we need another Oliver Cromwell.
Okay, Martin, yes. It is almost sometimes like the Civil War never happened, isn't it, with stories like this. We've got, in a way, a double-barrel thing going on here. One with the
Revolution of 1688, of course, was the real constitutional settlements in Britain.
Explain that. That happened after the Civil War.
Yeah, it was the final denouement where King William of Orange was brought over by a Protestant parliament to keep out Catholic King James. And, of course, the principle was then established that ultimately the king, although we've got a king, is ruling by consent of Parliament, and if Parliament decides not to have a king or to have a king from a different dynasty, that can happen and has happened. Now, I think I think we've got to distinguish here between these people as people with all of their flaws, and all of the nastiness about Prince Charles, I totally reject that. He's, you know, all of the kind of personal abuse that he's had to put up with, he's got my total sympathy on that front, because it's totally unfair, people having a go at him for no reason and all the rest of it. But on the other hand, we've inherited a constitutional mess in this country. Ask them in Belfast, and all of it will have to be sorted out at some point. Maybe now is a good time to start.
Okay, what about the tax status of the Duchy, though? Because he's neither a person or a corporation or a government.
Well, let me put something very radical to you. The Duchy of Cornwall, in fact, if you think about what I was saying about the Glorious Revolution there, in fact, the Duchy of Cornwall belongs to the British people, and we have lent it to Prince Charles. So whether he pays tax on it or not, we might decide in the future, if we're going to keep them on as employees, that they're going to take all of their actual wealth off them, because the Duchy of Cornwall and so on is, in fact, ultimately belongs to the British people. It's our gift to give it away.
Well, I mean, Ron was talking about Newton St. Lowe, which is part of the Duchy estate. Actually, supposedly, if you talk to people around there, he's a good landlord. You're paying a lot less to Prince Charles for a lovely cottage than you would if you had to buy it and pay a mortgage, for example.
I'm perfectly happy to accept that, but I do make the final point. I would make the point that since the Revolution of 1688... all royals in this country are there at our favour, at our beck and favour. If at some point we decided not to have them, we could. And in Australia, for example, they may decide so sometime soon. I'm not actually particularly that bothered about it. But on the other hand, I do resent the fact that they're massively wealthy independently, and at the same time they're employees of the state. Now that's got to be cleaned up. If they're going to be employees of the state, and that's what people are saying, they bring in tourism, they're worth the money, we could argue that the Duchy of Cornwall should actually belong to the state, and that might actually help us solve the deficit a bit, because we could take some of the profits from the Duchy of Cornwall and pay for swimming pools, for example, in East Bristol.
Okay, now on to the other end of the scale, that is those who are facing eviction because of the bedroom tax. Let's go to the House of Commons on Monday, where Lady Hollis explained that 8 out of 10 people affected by this new tax, the Conservative first call it something else, but anyway, we'll call it the bedroom tax, will go to private rented accommodation out of social housing. Therefore, it's almost certain, in fact, it's all a complete no-brainer, this is going to cost more.
Does the Minister accept that as a result, 660,000 families will have their lives turned upside down, and at the end of it, there will be no savings, but instead an increase in public expenditure?
What do you think, Ron?
No, absolutely right. I, as you know, put that bedroom tax motion to the City Council, no evictions, etc. There's 4,000 or so families directly affected in Bristol. And what's been said there is totally right. The Act is completely wrong in thinking it's going to save money, because driving people into the private rented sector in this part of the country is anything between 3 and 6 times greater in rent than it is if you're a social tenant.
So Martin, what possibly could motivate this? It's a bit like the old Remploy story, isn't it? Remploy people are sacked. Remploy, which is set up by Winston Churchill for disabled people to give them a little leg up when it comes to getting employment. All those people are, you know, literally thousands of people are put onto the dole. This is actually costing the taxpayer far more than if Remploy had been allowed to stay open. This is exactly the same. People are being shifted from social housing into private rented accommodation, and the government is going to have to pay far more in housing benefits.
Yes, but who owns that private rented accommodation? Oh, it's actually Tory MPs and others and people of that social group, the buy-to-let crowd. And so it's actually all free money for them when it comes down to it. That a lot of what is going on here is a vicious ideological attack on the poor for the sake of it. It's not even to try and save money. It's in order to try and rally the middle section of the population behind the status quo. And of course the Labour Party's failures in this regard are coming from their you know, spin doctors and focus groups, because of course for Labour to be re-elected or to be elected in 2015, they have to win various marginal constituencies, which are basically the satellite towns around London. Everybody knows this. It's Basingstoke, places like that. And therefore, of course, the swing voters in Basingstoke have to be given a narrative. And they've bought into the idea that people on benefits are scroungers, which is absolutely absurd, because most people on benefits are pensioners. Many people who are working are in receipt of benefits, like working tax credit and housing benefit, even while they're working. But the problem is, people in this country have been brainwashed into this pro-capitalist view of the world for 200 years. 200 years. Think back to Dickens and his critique of all this.
Martin, in the Post this week, number of jobless on benefits has dropped. New figures reveal the number of people claiming benefits while out of work has reduced in the Bristol area. In June, roughly 11,000 people claimed job seekers allowance, down from 11,500 in May.
All right. Well, let's talk about this, because when we're talking about the level of unemployment, there are two ways of measuring it. Basically, one is the people who are claiming benefits. The other is an internationally guaranteed or basically worked out system, which is called Labour Force Survey. Now, Labour Force Survey is a bit like doing a kind of opinion poll. You ask, you know, 1,000 people, are you in work? And if you're not in work, have you looked for work in the last 3 weeks? And that, of course, is the international comparison, because, you know, different benefit systems in different countries. I mean, in some countries, there isn't any unemployment benefit. That doesn't mean there's no unemployment. It just means there's no unemployment benefit. So the only international measure is Labour Force Survey. But, of course, what happens when, for example, there's a lot of people being sanctioned at the moment and removed from the benefits register. So that will show up in this as a decrease in unemployment. But what that means probably is that loads of people have had their money cut. That doesn't mean they've found a job. And of course, what they do is they use benefit claimants count when that suits them, and they use Labour Force Survey when that suits them. The fact is that there's been over 1 million people unemployed throughout my adult lifetime, and I'm 53, and there's still 2.5 million unemployed, nearly 1 million unemployed for more than a year, and I'm one of those people. And the fact is, the situation, we've stopped having full employment in this country in the 1970s, and there are far more people chasing every job than there are. If everybody got every vacancy that's available tomorrow, there'd still be 2 million unemployed. But that's the reality of the situation. Of course, we're going to be into an economic crisis now, which is going to make it even worse, but most people don't want to.
I think we're already there, actually.
No, we're not there yet. People think there's been a crisis. They're going to find there is a serious
Martin,
coming.
Just what is this analysis which says that actually for some economists, they think it's a good idea to have a big pool of unemployed people?
Oh, yes, because what you do having a big pool of unemployed people is you force down the wages of people in work because they're terrified. So what the difference between this and the 80s is in the 80s, most of the strain was taken by the unemployed, but real wages didn't fall. What we've now got is real wages being pushed down by quite substantial amounts because people are terrified of losing their jobs. You say, well, that's probably better. At least people are in jobs and they're out of work. You could argue that. But the problem with that is you're still draining demand out of the economy. Whether people are unemployed or having their wages cut, they can't go down the shops. And if they can't go down the shops, they can't spend. And at the end of that, you know what the end of that road is? The end of that road is Greece.
Ron, I mean, this is good news, though, isn't it? In the Post this week, the number of jobless on benefits has dropped in Bristol.
Well, like Martin says, I'm always worried about statistics and what's being compared, etc., like you've explained, Martin. And if I could see a real issue and it came forward that's solved or helped or promoted, real hope and benefit of jobs for young people in the city, for example, I can't see that at the minute. And we've got the enterprise zone, and we've seen all manner of issues created around that, and theoretical jobs in numbers being calculated in desktop computers. But I'm not seeing very much in the way of real employment in this city, and the benefits, it's so sad, they come in from these so-called government initiatives. And so the Bristol economy against some others in the core cities is relatively buoyant, but we've got an increase in population, and we've got an aging population that needs support. We've got an increasing number of young people that are looking for a future and jobs. And this last week, for example, we've seen at the top of Park Street hundreds of students graduating from either UWE or the University of Bristol. And the sad thing is that the majority of those will end up selling double glazing, not what they've been qualified in, because the jobs, the real jobs, are not out there.
Well, I mean, the government set a lot of store by this thing called the Work Programme, where private firms are commissioned to help people get jobs. But we heard last week that the Work Programme has delivered, apparently, worse than doing nothing. Martin, how is this, that a programme that's helped people get jobs has actually done actually less to find people jobs than the old system a couple of years ago when this was done through the Job Centre?
Well, that's because the Job Centre pretty much knew what they were doing, because they've been doing it for years, and what you've actually got in the Work Programme is very variable. I mean, my experience with the Work Programme has been relatively good. The Tomorrow's people who I've been dealing with are quite sophisticated. They were set up as a social enterprise in the 80s by Metropolitan Hotels after the first round of rioting. and the people I've been dealing with are actually quite sort of sensible. They're giving me sensible advice.
Well, I'm jealous because I'm on another which is called CTEC, yes, and they have been absolutely appalling.
And what you find, of course, is by spreading it out in this way, is you get total variability. Some people are getting good support, and other people are just getting a load of rubbish. And in actual fact, that's not good enough. Everybody ought to get adequate support rather than being at potluck.
Well, one of the reasons for all this, of course, is the power of lobbying and lobbyists. We've been talking about this over the last couple of weeks. And on Tuesday evening on Newsnight, we had a rare outing for Lord Bell, where he was discussing with Tory MP, Dr. Sarah Wollaston, about the power of lobbyists. Now, Lord Bell is himself a lobbyist, and it was interesting to hear his point of view.
To be a real Conservative, I believe that people should be paid for what they do. I don't think there's anything wrong with being paid, nor do I think everybody is corrupt.
Do you mind if big money changes policy? That's where we're going to. Does it matter if that happens?
Not if the policy that comes out of it is good.
So if somebody's got a lot of money, they should be able to influence policy?
No, that's not how it works. If you actually look at what lobbyists get paid, there was the financial, whatever it's called, the takeover panel decided to make financial companies publish the fees they paid public relations companies in order to discover whether or not they were being overpaid for doing takeover bids. Lo and behold, it turned out they weren't paid millions of pounds, they were paid tens of thousands of pounds.
I guess the question is, are the public sophisticated enough to see through, the people that are trying too hard, if you like? Do we really need regulation to sort this out?
I think the point is that the public have an absolute right to know who is behind, which is the big money behind organisations that are advising at the heart of government.
Isn't the worry that you paint the political classes as grubby, as corrupt, when we actually have one of the cleanest political systems in the world?
We certainly do.
And we do because people challenge, and we should continue to challenge. And this is it. And not unreasonable, in my opinion, to know.
It is absurd regulations that have made no difference anywhere else.
Come back to this here. Thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, that was Newsnight on Tuesday. The cleanest political system in the world.
Yes, and the City of London is the biggest sewer on the planet. If you're really talking about money laundering, where does that go on? It goes on in the Cayman Islands, which means the City of London.
But they're talking about the political system, not the city.
Yeah, but the political system is as corrupt as anywhere else. I mean, look at what's happened over the tobacco industry lobbying with Lyndon Crosby. The Prime Minister has admitted that he had talked to Lyndon Crosby about not doing, putting plain cigarette packaging in, because, of course, he opposed that in Australia, and, of course, it's not gone through. Now, I'm not. We could discuss the tobacco issue separately, but it's quite clear that the policy, and when of course Bernie Eccleston demanded of Tony Blair exactly the same policy, and what then? Big tobacco basically decides what it wants and tells the politicians. The politicians go, yeah, politicians need money. Yeah,
Is big money buying politics, making laws in this country?
Well, certainly not as a councillor, I can assure you of that. The MPs are going to vote...
They're not buying you in any way.
No. I got to declare anything over 25 quid, so I don't think that's going to rock.
But what on a national scale, the new laws that are coming in? I mean, for example, this particular one is... I mean, we've got all sorts going on at the moment. There's also the potential of all these new types of fossil fuels. We heard this morning, I couldn't believe the BBC News saying that shale gas was got out of the ground by putting water into the ground. No, BBC, it's not water. It's toxic chemicals and maybe some water too. But this seems to be part of the lobbying that seems to be going on by these oil companies. Anyway, before I blow my top here, let's have another listen to... this is Prime Minister's question. This is actually Jane Wally asking a question about oil and gas price fixing. And also, this is also very much related to what Martin was saying about this Conservative employee Lyndon Crosby at the heart of government.
Molly. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Given the scandal of price fixing in the oil and gas industry that's currently being investigated by the European Union, does the Prime Minister agree with me that it's important to be absolutely transparent about the oil and gas companies that Lyndon Crosby's lobbying firm has represented?
They got nothing to say about unemployment, about improving education, about capping welfare. But let me it pains me to point this out to the Honourable Lady, but she has received £32,000 from affiliated trade unions. Now this is, wait, let me explain the difference. With Linton Crosby, the Conservative Party gives him money to help us get rid of Labour, right? That's the way it works. With the Labour Party, the unions give you money. That's the way it works. And she said this on her website. I'm a member of Unison and Unite, and I regularly raise trade union issues in Parliament. They pay the money in, they get the results out. That's the scandal in British politics.
I mean, he is a bit rich, surely, Martin. He's a bit rich for the criticism, Labour criticising the Conservatives over these lobbyists, people like Lord Bell or Linton Crosby, when actually the same exact thing is going on with the unions in Labour.
Listen, in Scandinavia, since 1945, all politics is funded by the state, all of it, and no other money is allowed. The other end of the spectrum is the United States of America, where the Supreme Court, which has been packed by the Republicans, allows any amount of money to be spent on any political campaign, and no, you're not even allowed to know how much or who spent it. That's the other end of the scale. The fact of the matter is, everybody in the dogs in the street know that the who decides the policies in the Western world. It's the military-industrial complex and the banks, and all the politics is just window dressing. And until we address that, we're not going to change anything. But of course, we're not going to address it until people realise that the people running the show are not just venal, they're quite obviously that, but they're also grotesquely incompetent.
Well, we can't say that about our mayor, George Ferguson, of course, Ron. One thing I would point out is that he was in here a couple of weeks ago, and we were having a discussion about KPMG, this big financial services firm, which is being investigated by the Competition Commission for price fixing, just as the oil companies are, as the MP there just said. And a deal has now just been done, presumably brokered by the volunteer from KPMG, who's helping Mayor Ferguson with the accounts of the city, to buy the KPMG headquarters. All starts to look a little bit like that these people aren't really there as volunteers at all. They're there to cut deals at the heart of government and actually take taxpayers' money.
Well, there are, I think, an increasing number of issues in the course of this year and the next 3 years that the mayor's going to have to tread a very careful line, on the basis that he is an investor, he is, you know, a rich man. He does have contacts and indeed interests in the city. And I believe that that's going to be a problem for him to balance that legitimately. And I think there are questions to be asked in relation to issues such as you raise, in relation to what is his exact role, what is his exact interest, and how much of that is a conflict of interest, or is it insider dealing, or what is the actual structure?
I mean, you could say that for anybody, couldn't you? Anybody, not just George. At the end of the day, Ron, you know, if someone is a businessman in the city or a businesswoman, there's no reason why they can't be mayor.
Yeah, I understand that, but let's face it, the city council is the biggest employer in the whole of Bristol. It's got interest right across the city in the ability to be able to develop or put forward projects. And we've got somebody, a single individual at the top of a pyramid, that completely overrules 70 elected councillors and can do what he wants until 2016.
But I hate to point this out, Ron, but the people of Bristol voted for that.
No, 28% of the people voted for it. 72%
well,
went
didn't
down
want
to
it,
George Park on a nice day.
The people who didn't vote should have got on their bikes and voted, shouldn't they? Anyway, back to the House of Commons now. There's a special treat for Martin, and it's Paul Flynn from Newport, the MP from across the other side of the Severn Estuary. This time he's talking about how terrible Prime Minister's questions has become.
Should be heard with courtesy. Paul Flynn. Yeah.
Will the Prime Minister study the precise meaning of the word question and the precise meaning of the word answer and the need for a link between the two? following the record number of unanswered questions and the record number of pre-prepared party political jibes last week at question time. A demeaning spectacle that shames him and his office. Can he make a start by giving me an answer today to this question that is both relevant and courteous?
Well, I'm assuming that one was a bit complicated for a whip's handout question, so he probably did actually think of it himself. But actually, this government is far more transparent than any of its predecessors about the information we publish, the public spending data we give, far more transparent than the last government.
Funnily enough, he didn't actually answer the question, did he? Does he know the difference between a question and an answer? Has he studied these things? Martin, what are your thoughts? Are you vindicated, you think, there by Paul Flynn?
Well, it's like we were talking earlier about the Glorious Revolution and the history of the country and so on, and the fact that we put up with second-rate public services. We put up with second-rate politics as well, and Prime Minister's questions is gutter politics. It's a nonsense, really. In other countries, they just roll their eyes.
Ron?
Well, it's the soundbite, isn't it, for the day on...
Dumbing down.
On I mean, the Speaker could night. Intervene. The Speaker could say, answer the question. He could actually intervene.
Well, in the Polish Sejm where I've been, it's like watching paint dry. It's very boring. It's a circular chamber, so everybody sits in a circle, and you get 10 minutes to make your speech. Everybody gets 10 minutes. You've got a green light, and then the green light flashes, then you get a red light, and then you're off, like Tony's saying here. But everybody just sits and listens. It's very boring. There's no shouting, no screaming. It's a place of work. And, of course, what's happened with the House of Commons, it's just become an entertainment.
Now, another story. Today in The Independent, a serious organised crime agency has refused to disclose the names of blue-chip companies who commissioned corrupt private investigators who broke the law, because revealing them would damage those firms' commercial interests, The Independent's learned. Martin, we've heard about the serious organised crime agency before, haven't we? Rowan Bosworth Davis, for example, saying that they were rubbish, basically. And here we have evidence of criminal use of private investigators to steal information. And yet, note that a serious organised crime agency is not going to be doing an investigation because it might damage the commercial interests of the companies that have been committing these crimes.
Well, as we all know, the police are too busy infiltrating the environmental movement to bother about stuff like this. There's, you know, long-term targeting of young activists to give them babies. It's, you know, this fraud stuff is not, you know, the police aren't interested.
Ron, I mean, what is going on here? Because this is corporate crime, quite clearly. There's very clear evidence of this. And serious organised crime agency have said, well, we can't actually investigate these companies because it would affect their commercial interests. Does that mean that a corporation, if you're a director of a big company, you're above the law?
No, it shouldn't do, but what it does mean is, I think, coming back to what Martin said, that there's so much power of money and money's talks, and other interest groups, etc., are the ones that people focus on. We haven't got the clout and the financial influence to be able to, if you like, buy off the law.
I mean, from this story, does it sound like we've got a rule of law in this country anymore?
No.
I think we haven't, and as Rowan Bosworth Davis has pointed out, most of the activities of the city are in fact criminal. And people say, well, you can't say that. We can, we do, we are saying it, and of course it's going to crash, and at that point people will wake up, because we think that we're going to stumble along. We're not. The situation is much worse than
And The Independent's been on a bit of a roll. Another story this week: the government has approved thousands of deals with states it condemns for human rights abuses. More than 3,000 export licenses have been given for military and intelligence equipment worth a total of $12.3 billion to countries which are on its own official list for abusing human rights. The existence of one license to Israel and the occupied territories has not been public until today. And that's in The Independent. I'll put a link up on that programme page, www.thisweek.org.uk. Okay, but I'm going to ask Ron to stay, because we're going to be talking housing after the 6 o'clock news. The Murdoch News at 6.
3.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, the wife...